listening to Muslimish Freethinkers, a podcast dedicated to fostering conversations on matters of faith and disbelief.
Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, everyone around the world. This is Muslimish live broadcast coming to you. This is Wissam Sharafuddin speaking to you, co-founder of Muslimish. And today we have the honor and pleasure of having a very important broadcast. And I will be introducing our guests and speakers in a second. Today we speak again about discrimination against atheists, human rights, violations, and blasphemy laws. Blasphemy law is a law prohibiting blasphemy, where blasphemy is the act of insulting or showing contempt or lack of reverence to a deity or sacred things or towards something considered sacred. According to Pew Research Center, about a quarter of the world's countries and territories, 26% of the world, have anti-blasphemy laws or policies as of 2014. Blasphemy laws are commonly used around the world to persecute people for beliefs and activities that do not conform to majority opinion on religious and sensitive topics, and to suppress criticism of religion. They have been subject to repeated condemnations by human rights organizations and resolutions of the United Nations Human Rights Council. Today we'll be focusing on one country as an example, and this country is Lebanon, a country considered one of the most open-minded in the Middle East, with a very diverse ethnicities and religious backgrounds. Usually atheists function freely in Lebanon. That's the perception of most of the world, especially the Arab and Muslim world. Today we'll be examining that detailed matter based on the research that has been done by Freethought Lebanon. Allow me to introduce the panel with us today. Ibrahim Abdullah is the founder of Muslimish, an Egyptian-American atheist who grew up as a Muslim in Alexandria. He moved to the United States in 2002 and was forced by overwhelming scientific information to admit the faulty nature of Islam and all religions in 2011, and with the help of the Center for Inquiry, a secular humanist group, he organized the first Muslimish meeting in New York on May 30, 2012. He takes pride in being one of the founding members of Muslimish, who shaped the core principles and goals of the group, creating a safe environment for discussion, fostering a pluralistic society, and abolishing blasphemy laws across the globe. You can reach him at ibrahim@muslimish.org. We also have with us from CFI, Jennifer Behan is the executive director for CFI Michigan. She is responsible for the day-to-day operations of CFI Michigan and is working to build a secular community throughout Michigan. Her interests include volunteer management, program development and evaluation, secular activism, and women's rights. She holds a bachelor's of music education. And in addition to her work for CFI, she teaches private music lessons on piano and woodwinds. Prior to being hired by CFI Michigan, Jennifer volunteered there for 4 years and was the editor of a quarterly newsletter, assisted in long-term planning, and founded several ongoing programs. I know, Jennifer, that this needs updating, but I grabbed it from the site. We also have Sami. Sami Abdullah is the president and co-founder of Freethought Lebanon and a diligent Lebanese civil society activist. A theoretical physicist by profession, Sami is passionate about both pursuing scientific truth and defending basic human rights. His upbringing in a conservative community in Beirut as well as his firsthand experience and the hardships of religious indoctrination as a young student, propelled him to rebel against the status quo and endeavor to empower and protect freethinkers in Lebanon and around the world and fight against religious misogyny. We also have Mazen. Abu Hamdan is a Lebanese civil rights activist and co-founder and editor-in-chief of Freethought Lebanon. He is a graduate of political philosophy and is currently completing a master's degree in the philosophy and strategies of nonviolence. Mazen currently holds the position of peace building and governance lead at Mercy Corps, Lebanon. In his personal time, Mazen is interested in collecting and learning how to play musical instruments from around the world. I've witnessed that, Mazen, on your Facebook. Good job. Sarah Haraki, she's joining us today, is a core member and an author of Freethought Lebanon and a civil rights activist. She's an international certified teacher, translator, and an editor from Beirut, continuing her master's degree in Germany. Sarah is driven by the injustices she witnesses done by religion and by her firsthand experiences of religious tyranny and upbringing in the religious areas of Lebanon to stand against religious and societal oppression. Welcome everyone with us in this broadcast, and thank you for being with us. I want to start with Jennifer just introducing Center for Inquiry before we go on to Sami to introduce us to Freethought Lebanon.
Well, thank you so much for having us. Can you hear me okay?
It's a little bit low, Jennifer.
Okay. I will try to speak up.
It's okay, I'll raise it from my end.
So Center for Inquiry, I run Center for Inquiry Michigan, but Center for Inquiry, the national group, was founded by Paul Kurtz in the 1990s as a support organization for two other groups, the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry and the Council for Secular Humanism. And they have programs throughout the world. And one of the ones that would be most relevant tonight is their Secular Rescue Program that was founded a number of years ago to help secular individuals and atheists who are in countries where their disbelief is not recognized or is outright challenged, as I know many of you on this call are very familiar with. And so it was through that connection that I met with Sam and Ibrahim, and I had the pleasure of being at that meeting in 2012, thanks to the generous invite of Wissam to help those guys get organized. And so the CFI's program, Secular Rescue, helps, I think, a couple dozen people a year. Most of the time, it's just connecting them to resources. And a few people each year, we actually have a special fund that helps to try and get people visas and helps to extricate them from dangerous situations. So you can check that out at secularrescue.org. And then in Michigan, I work at the grassroots level and often collaborate with Sam and other groups to host lectures and events to help raise awareness about the issues and also just build secular community in the state.
Thank you, Jennifer. Sami, I'd like you to introduce Freethought Lebanon to us and then introduce the first video that we'll be watching and the research that has been done behind it. Can you unmute yourself, please?
Excuse me. So thank you, Wissam. Hello, everybody. And thank you for this very beautiful gathering. And so Freethought Lebanon was founded in 2007. That's quite a long time ago. We first started working under the name CLAFA, which stood for Coalition of Lebanese Atheists, Freethinkers, and Agnostics. And in the year 2016, we decided, so in the beginning, we were more focused strictly on the rights of non-religious people, and we decided to widen the scope a little bit. And then we changed our name to Freethought Lebanon. And currently, I would say we are mostly, our main focus is taboos. Any taboos that we have in Lebanon, we want to break those taboos. Any restrictions we have on freedoms, we want to fight those restrictions. So I would say we are mostly interested in freedoms in general, and in particular, freedom of speech. and minority rights in general, and in particular the rights of the non-religious. Why the non-religious? Not because they are better than other people, but mostly because there's nobody else doing this job in Lebanon. And so concerning the last project that we've been doing, so the project is called Atheists in Lebanon. It's a report, it's a very detailed report about the human rights violations and discriminations against atheists in Lebanon. So the report was conducted over a period of 6 months. 19 people contributed in this work, and it had four main categories. The first one was a legal report in which we studied the discriminations by the law. The second one was a media analysis in which we digged into the biases committed by the media, Lebanese mainstream media channels against the atheists. The third one was the case studies, which was basically 40 interviews with victims of discrimination against atheists. And finally, maybe the most interesting finding was the survey, which was the first survey ever about discrimination against atheists. So this was a perception survey conducted with atheists in Lebanon, 644 in particular. And maybe we can start right away by watching the main findings of this survey in this 5 minutes video we saw.
Okay, thank you, Sam. So we'll be playing the video right now, and then you can comment on it, and we go from there.
So the video is in Arabic, and there's English subtitles, so yeah.
And by the way, if you want to, for those participants, if you want to maximize the screen, just double-click on the output screen.
الجمهورية اللبنانية ما بتعترف بالمواطنين إلا باعتبارهم أتباع لطوايف تتقاسم بين السلطات وبتدير علاقة المواطن بالدولة، وهالشي معروف ومتفق عليه من زمن تأسيس النظام اللبناني لليوم. ولكن شو أثر هالواقع على الحياة اليومية؟ كيف بيعيش الملحد أو اللاديني بلبنان؟ هيدا هو السؤال، والجواب عن 644 شخص استطلعناهم بدراسة إحصائية هي الأولى من نوعها بلبنان والمنطقة. اعتمدت هالدراسة عينة عشوائية من اللادينيين جاوبوا على 41 سؤال بيهتفوا لاستطلاع تجارب التمييز السلبي يلي عاشوها أو عايشينها بالعيلة مع الأصدقاء وبمكان العمل. رغم عشوائية العينة ظهر تشابه بين توزيع الأفراد حسب خلفياتهم الطائفية وبين التوزيع السكاني على الطوائف بلبنان، بشكل بيدل على أنه الإلحاد ما بيقتصر على طوائف ولا يستثني غيرها. 63% من المستطلعين تعرضوا للتمييز السلبي بدرجة بين متوسطة وعالية بسبب مواقفهم الفكرية. أعلى نسب للتمييز السلبي تعرضوا له اللادينيين الساكنين ضمن محافظة الجنوب ومحافظة النبطية بالدرجة الأولى ومحافظة الشمال بالدرجة الثانية. من جهة أخرى بيتعرض المسلمين السابقين للتمييز السلبي بنسب أعلى من يلي بيتعرضوا له المسيحيين السابقين والدروز السابقين. 27% شعروا بوقت من الأوقات أنه حياتهم أو سلامتهم أو مصالحهم مهددة بسبب إعلانهم للإلحاد. أكثر من 40% من هالأشخاص عايشين حالياً تحت هالتهديد. من خلال التمييز السلبي ووسائل ضغط مختلفة، تم إجبار ثلث المستطلعين على ممارسة طقوس دينية بالإكراه مثل الصوم أو ارتداء الحجاب أو الصلاة بالكنيسة أو الجامعة. حوالي 60% اضطروا يمثلوا على أفراد العيلة والمحيط أنه بيمارسوا الطقوس الدينية لاكتفاء الشرور أو لنيل الرضا. هل النظام السياسي والقوانين اللبنانية بتميز ضد الملحدين واللادينيين؟ تقريباً أجمعت العينة على أنه النظام السياسي ما بيحترم وجودهم ولا بيعترف فيهم. أكثر من 70% بيعتبروا أنه التصريح بالإلحاد ممكن يورطهم بمشاكل قانونية، وأكثر من 90% صرحوا أنه مارسوا بدرجات متفاوتة الرقابة الذاتية على التعبير حتى يتفادوا نتائج سلبية اجتماعية أو قانونية. رغم التشابه بالنسب بين الجنسين عموماً، لما حددنا قوانين الأحوال الشخصية بالسؤال، 84% من النساء اعتبروا أن القوانين بتميز ضد اللادينيين مقابل 69% من الرجال. هالفرق الكبير ناتج بطبيعة الحال عن التمييز السلبي ضد النساء بالمجتمع على أكثر من مستوى بصرف النظر عن الإلحاد أو التدين. قوانين الحضانة والإرث متخلفة لدرجة الإجرام، قالت إحدى المشاركات بالاستطلاع، ومشاركة تانية بتقول إذا عرفت المحكمة أني ملحدة ما بورت ليرة من زوجي، وتالتة بتقول الكنيسة ما بتعتبر اغتصاب الزوجة جريمة بتبرر الطلاق، بالإضافة لشكاوى أخرى متنوعة بمواضيع الزواج والطلاق والميراث والحضانة وأعطاء الجنسية للأطفال من زوج أجنبي. بالنتيجة تراكم التمييز فوق التمييز حتى وصل لتجارب كتير صعبة للنساء اللادينيات. بالسؤال عن العلاقات بالمجتمع، 65% من الملحدين بيصرحوا عن مواقفهم الفكرية لأفراد العيلة و80% بيصرحوا للأصدقاء. أما بالعلاقات المهنية الموضوع بيختلف والنسبة بتنزل لأقل من النص، والسبب حسب المستطلعين هو الخوف من تأثير هالتصريح على وضعهم المهني. بالخلاصة ببلد مثل لبنان مبني على التقاسم الطائفي للسلطات والامتيازات، وخصوصاً بعد الحروب الطائفية المتعددة اللي كرست القوة بإيد الطوايف، كانت النتيجة التمادي بتهميش كل المواطنين غير المنتمين للطوايف واعتبارهم غير موجودين. الهدف من هالدراسة هو مواجهة الأمر الواقع ولفت النظر لحقيقة أنه التهميش والتعتيم ما بيبني مجتمع صحيح، وأنه لابد من الاعتراف بالجميع كمواطنين وحماية حقوقهم وحرياتهم، ومنها حرية المعتقد أو عدم الاعتقاد.
Thank you very much, guys. Free Thought Lebanon, we extend to you much appreciation for this effort and for this report that speaks on behalf of human rights and freedom of expression. Sami, I don't want to ask questions before you speak about the video a little bit, but I want to include, maybe you can address that while you're speaking about it. There is an impression that Lebanon is a country that tolerates all kinds of different beliefs, including atheism. There's an open communist party. There are figures like Ziad al-Rahbani, for example, who are very famous and popular, yet they are atheists. How does this report enlighten us as to the intricacies of that claim?
I think this report, the main thing that it tells us is how bad things are in the Arab world. Is if the country that we see as the least oppressive when it comes to atheism is showing high discrimination, then what can we say about the rest of the region? I think what this also says, and like this is partially my personal opinion, is that atheism is still a taboo that was not really brought to the public yet. You know, there are many taboos in Lebanon. Some of them, they were brought to the public, but for some reason, we have a thing with atheism in Lebanon. So, for example, if you refer to people who are not very religious or even non-religious, it could be fine until you use the word atheist. So this word is still equated with Satanism. It's still like people still think that atheists are immoral, and they didn't come in peace with this term yet. And I was personally a bit surprised to see the backlash that we were recently receiving on the page upon publishing the results. Of course, I never expected that things are fine in Lebanon. I never expected that atheists were accepted, but I was a bit surprised by how intense the backlash was. I didn't know where were all these people sleeping all this time. Where was this hate hidden, you know? So, yeah.
Thank you, Sami. Jennifer, you probably have to leave earlier, right?
Do you still have to leave? Just before 6:30.
Okay, so I'm going to let you start with the first question yourself.
Oh, I'm asking a question? I thought you were going to
If you want to discuss, open the discussion with Sami about this report and how far we are in America. In America also it has been found by Pew Research that atheists are one of the most disliked minorities in the country. If you want to address that in your work.
Yeah, so blasphemy, one of the things that CFI has worked on the most in this regard is fighting those blasphemy laws directly through our status at the UN. And we obviously have we're only a special envoy recognition with the United Nations. So we don't have a lot of power with that, but we recognize that blasphemy laws really are a political tool, right? They're based on a religious belief, or they claim to be, but really it's about silencing positions that people don't agree with. And I know that especially in a lot of Arab countries, that's really, really specific. An issue where that's not something in the United States. But as you were saying, Wissam, we are still, I think we're actually atheists and Muslims by people who don't understand some of the better understanding of the religions are actually on a very similar par of being disliked by white evangelical Christians. So let's be very specific about what subset of the country holds those beliefs. But I guess one of the things that that I would like to discuss is what can people who do that recognize this as a problem? I know that we actually at CFI are working with a coalition to try and get the United States Congress to recognize that blasphemy laws in other countries are a problem because they're used as a political tool to discriminate against people who are trying to fight against especially oppressive regimes in different areas. So to the other people on the call, what is some, you know, how can we actually help rather than, you know, the armchair activism? Like what are things that we could actually do? Is that effective to get Congress involved, or what are things that we can do to help directly if there is something we can do?
Mazen, would you like to take this question or?
Sure. Can you hear me properly?
Yes, yeah. We can.
Yep.
Okay. So the thing about Lebanon is you must understand the political dynamic and the historical context of how things came to be. Basically, Lebanon used to be part of the Ottoman Empire, which was Turkey. And once Turkey fell after the First World War, Lebanon was taken over by the French Mandate, and a country was born just over 100 years ago, with the main goal of having a country for Christian minorities in the Middle East, because Christians used to fear being dissolved in a larger Muslim Arab world. So the way the country was formed and the borders, the way they were drawn, it's basically very random and not really based on any logical citizenship, country building standards, but just have this demographic majority in this area. Let's give them a port and a piece of land where they can grow their own food. And let's add random groups of religious confessions to that mix. So pretty much, if you want to think about Lebanon, I try to imagine it as if you went down to the street, gathered 7 or 8 strangers, put them in a room and told them you're a family and good luck. Try figuring things out. Sorry, so if you want to, like, just one interesting fact about Lebanon, the last time we had a national census, like accounting of the population, it was the year 1932, and we haven't had one since then. And the reason is how many people are with members of each religious group affects the way the political power is distributed. So the very foundation of the country has been built on power division between Christian Maronites, Christian Orthodox, Sunnis, Shias, Druze, and all many other groups. So I think since then, the West, the French, they approached our area with the mentality of let's have stability. And I think that's a very dangerous world when approaching Middle Eastern politics, because under the name of stability, many times the foreign policies of countries would be to support the status quo. But this stability pretty much is basically creating a country in which there are no citizens, only members of religious groups, and you can only become a prime minister if you're Sunni, a president if you're Christian, and so on. So I think what you can do to push is just understand the whole sectarian power division. And maybe if the international community can push for a more of more secularization of Lebanon, more citizenship building, less sectarianism in politics, because right now it's not just about atheist rights. It's about if you have a corrupt minister, let's say if he happens to be Sunni, and you say he's corrupt, he should be accountable. The Sunnis would say this is an attack against our representative in government, and it would turn into a sectarian discussion, and it would get nowhere. So anyway, sectarianism is currently playing the role of immunity against accountability. So I would say, just, I mean, if the international community can push for secularization, citizenship building, state building, and end of sectarian laws, and overcoming this fear of maintaining stability alone, because right now stability is really maintaining the status quo, which is quite harmful.
Thank you. Thank you, Mazen, for
maybe if I want to be a little bit more specific, Jennifer, so I would say the most basic thing you can do is, so Lebanon has signed many international treaties, and there's a law in Lebanon that says that if there's a conflict between the Lebanese law and the international law, the judges in Lebanon, they are forced to follow the international laws. And Lebanon is not only one of the people who signed the International Declaration of Human Rights, it's one of the countries who drafted it. So there's obviously some contradictions between what Lebanon had signed and what Lebanon is, the government Lebanon actually practicing. And what's happening in Lebanon is beyond blasphemy laws. So the problems, as Wissam is showing us here, so this is one of the contradictions between the Article 13 of the International Declaration of Human Rights and the Lebanese Constitution. So yeah, the problem in Lebanon is beyond blasphemy laws. It's not only blasphemy, it's any kind of anything that could be perceived as degrading to religions. Or for example, if there's some religious ceremony and you went next to it and I don't know, you made some noise, you could be accused by disturbing what is this thing they always use, the anything that might
strife, that's the word.
This is the word that they always use. Anything they want to, if they want to silence people, this is what they would always use, sectarian strife. So yeah, it's way beyond blasphemy. So the reason why we basically did this research study is to have for the first time some numbers, you know, some concrete evidence, because there's a lot of human rights violations, they just need to be written down. So we took this initiative, and it's some of us are academics, including myself, and we made sure that all of the methodology was properly done, everything was done objectively. So, and the reason why is because we want this to be used by the international community. We want them to have something solid to see with their eyes and to build on. If somebody wants to interfere, how to interfere, this is a very big question. Lebanese politics is really complicated. And there are many big players, but I think any pressure that's done by human rights organizations is always appreciated and it always helps.
Thank you, Sami. We will go to Ibrahim now to ask his question, and after that, I have a question for Sarah. Yes, Ibrahim.
Thank you, everyone, for coming, and thank you, Sam, for organizing this. First, I want to thank you guys in Freethought Lebanon for doing this report. It's very it's eye-opening, especially for someone like, I'm Egyptian-American. I grew up in Egypt, where we think Lebanon is much more open-minded than us, which it is much more open-minded than Egypt. And it was very surprising to me to see that, you know, that there are a lot of obstacles against free thought in a country that is the epitome in free thought in that part of the world. Can you tell me? Well, okay. So my understanding and what I've learned more and more since is that Lebanon is a unique situation. There's the sect division, which is. First of all, does that even exist in any other country in the world? Is there any other country in the world where the president has to be Christian and the prime minister Sunni and the parliament president? Like, is there any other country in the world that has that division?
Mazen, is there? I don't think so.
Not sure. Probably not. We're unique that way.
Okay, so that's one unique situation. Another unique situation is the report that you've done. That's another unique situation. Is there any other Arab country where we were able to run such a report and, you know, get data like this from other Arab countries about the condition of free thought in a country?
Such a study, I don't think so, but there's the Arab Atheists magazine. It's not a study, but I think you're aware of the magazine. But such
yes,
a study,
I am.
But we really hope that this will push other people in the Arab world to do similar studies, and we are really willing to help by providing all the methodologies, the advice, so all the resources we collected, we are willing to share because we really want this done in other countries.
Okay. And another question I have is, how do you think the majority of Lebanese view their identity? Is the national identity, the Lebanese identity, in existence at all? Or everybody identifies with their sect, or they identify as something else? Like, you know, I'm not gonna make any examples, but I'm just saying, like, do people identify as Lebanese or as Sunni, Shia, and Maroni, and whatever?
I think
I can answer that. It's my line of work. So basically, Lebanon has 18 official religious groups. Many Christian, many Muslim, and even Jews and Druze. And these definitely do not have the same sense of identity. Actually, one of the funny things about Lebanese politics is the discussion of whether Lebanese are Arabs or not. And usually you have Muslims are more likely to say, yes, we are Arabs, and Christians who want to say that, no, we are unique, we are different, and they say, no, we are Phoenicians. And they use this historical reference of like 2,000 years ago where we had Phoenicians in Lebanon. So even after we had the civil war, which was mostly fought according to religious lines, and they wanted to write a new constitution, and this was a debate, like what do you put in the constitution? Is Lebanon an Arab country or not? And they eventually had the compromise where they said Lebanon is a country with an Arab face, which is very the wajah Arabi, which is neither yes nor no. So we have this issue. We have failed to manage diversity properly over the last 100 years. It has always been a state of competition between different religious groups to get more power. And oftentimes, because they have no common identity, whenever there's any regional conflict, any international conflict, different parts of the Lebanese community would ally with different regional players. So right now you have some people with Saudi Arabia, others with Iran. In the past, you had some people with the Europeans and others with Abdel Nasser, sometimes with the Palestinians, sometimes anti-Palestinians. So we always have these issues because we have no common identity. I think most recently, the revolution that happened in 2019 has started to break away those barriers. And there is hope of building a new identity on the basis of non-sectarianism, citizenship. But it's still blossoming and far from realized.
Thank you, Mazen. Sarah, first of all, we hope that you feel better. And thank you for actually, staying or honoring the commitment of being with us today, even from the hospital bed. So thank you very much. We appreciate it. And we hope that you get better. You definitely look very good. So that's a good sign. Sarah, a question about the process. I know that you were on the ground collecting the surveys. Tell us about that experience. It's a very unique experience, especially dealing with people sometimes who have dealt with trauma or they still have fear, like the survey have shown. How did you see these reactions? Anything that surprised you in the process?
Okay, so first I handled the section of the case studies, but I wasn't doing it alone. I had my colleague working with me. She preferred not to show her face because she is personally still wearing the veil by force. And this shows you how much complicated it is there in Lebanon, that even you have atheists secretly and working on such projects and they are still oppressed. And as for the cases, we had to approach some people because not all of them in the beginning were willing to share their stories. They were afraid for their privacy. But I think what helped at the end, especially with the forcefully veiled girls, is that the people doing the interviews, Michael, Ling, and I, are females. And usually women who are forced to wear the veil find it easier to confide in females than to confide in a man asking them about such sensitive questions. So I think this is part of what helped in maybe having this huge number of forcefully veiled girls among a number of the interviews we had. And as for the traumas, yes, like most of them have trauma. Like a lot of them told me they were diagnosed by a therapist with complex PTSD or PTSD, you know, and the trauma is still there. You can feel it in their lives and the way they are talking. It's a really kind of, some of them got ruined by it forever. You can see it. And like there were all kinds of abuse, like other than the being forced to wear the veil, there were people who were physically abused. And by physical abuse, I mean intense physical abuse for years, not just like one incident. There were people like who, for example, we had a case, or several other cases, but mainly that main case that were, they lost their job just because they said openly that I am an atheist. And of course, the main problems or the backlash was from close family members. And even at schools, we had people who were bullied at school by their peers just because they were an atheist. But there's something notable here and the results, but I can't have an exact answer for it, is that most of the people were ex-Muslims. And you can see that the most cases with the most abuse were the ex-Muslims. And here, why I don't have an exact answer, why is this? Like, is it that the Muslims are more brutal than the Christians, or what's it? I think maybe my colleague and I, perhaps we have more contact with people who are ex-Muslims, or perhaps the ex-Muslims are just more vocal about it. Or in general, maybe Muslims are more abusive than Christians. So, or it could be a combination of all these three options together. And when you asked me how about the trauma, etc., like why I also felt it is my colleague and I both, because even my colleague told you she's still wearing the veil by force. I also was, I used to wear the veil. I wore it for 11 years. So when the people were confiding in me and sharing their stories, one of the reasons that made it easier for them to speak to me is that I was like them. So I'm someone who understands and they can speak to. And also it made it hard for me at some point to just like stay professional the whole time and put my emotions on the side. So it was like a roller coaster of emotions, but it's something that I really like to do.
Thank you, Sarah. We'll go next to Jennifer. But before that, Sammy, I want to address two terms here that are used to be clarified. One, when we use the term oppressed or abused, let's talk a little bit about this, because sometimes it's not necessarily physical abuse, sometimes just the societal pressure, just knowing that there are consequences. They might be subtle or long-term. They might be loss of job or loss of connections. Let's talk, can you clarify, the different kinds of abuse that usually can face an atheist? And also when you mentioned taboos, I just want to clarify, I want you to clarify that, you know, when we talk about taboos, what kind of taboos we're talking about? Sometimes there are good taboos that, exist with everyone. But what taboos are we talking about specifically that you feel that they need to be broken because they are associated with, human rights violations or suppression of freedoms?
Mm-hmm. So for the first question, I think the case studies, they were studying like real oppression. So if you follow, if you check like the results of the survey, you would see the general things that atheists suffer from the very severe to the not very severe things. But the case studies were directed at real oppression, and just going through these stories, it's like 40 long stories. Half of them are about forcefully veiled women, and the other half are just different things. And yeah, just going through them is really depressive, honestly. And yeah, there were many different examples of like domestic violence, people who were forced to do wear the veil, people who were forced to practice religion, people who were kicked out of their houses because they were not religious, people who were kicked out of their jobs, yeah. Concerning your second question about the taboo, I think the biggest taboo we have in Lebanon is discussing religion or anything that might portray religions in any negative way. And this is one of the things that we are trying to help with. We are trying to teach people the difference between attacking persons and between attacking ideas, and how attacking ideas should be permitted no matter where these ideas come from, and that religious teachings, they are seen as holy not because they are holy, just because it happened that religious people had power in Lebanon and they just put these laws, you know. This is what I meant by, this is the main taboo, I would say, discussing. But other than this, of course, LGBT rights are seen as taboos. The word atheist and atheists in general, this is one of the big taboos. Mazen, maybe you can add something about this fast, or because we were discussing this just today, Mazen and I.
Sure, we just have a culture in Lebanon where we do not like to have difficult conversations. We just live in denial. Even how these people see each other or see people from the other sect, we just don't discuss this. Even after the Civil War ended, we had 15 years of massacre and maybe 100,000 casualties. And after it was done, we decided not to discuss this at all. Just to pretend that it never happened, and let's move on. We have a very unhealthy attitude as a people, as a culture, towards difficult conversations, and this is, causes problems on all fronts. So I think what we try to do is we just try to say that nothing is off the limits when it comes to being discussed. Everything can be discussed, and nuance is always needed. So in addition to atheism, secularism, LGBT issues, in a few weeks we're going to host an event to discuss the right to have a secular funeral. So how can you die and not be forced to be buried according to religious ceremonies, but have your own thing to be burned or to be to donate your organs or whatever you want. So this is a very taboo topic. So we just try to push the realms of free speech, of free rational discourse. And we're quite happy. I think we sum it up by always saying, people have rights, ideas do not have rights, and all ideas can be discussed.
Thank you, Mazen. And from Beirut to Grand Rapids, Beirut, where civil marriage is still prohibited, and with Jennifer in Grand Rapids, Michigan, who has fought for the rights of secularists to have a secular marriage. Can you comment on that, Jennifer, and any question or point of discussion you'd like to add?
Yeah, so the thing that I keep hearing, and this sounds like such a complex issue, and obviously being in the position I'm in, I've dealt with the intersection of religion and politics in the United States, but that Lebanon, as Ibrahim was having clarified, the same question is there any other country in the world that is like this? Like, it seems like you're in this really interesting puzzle. And yes, we just recently were able to secure the right for secular individuals to have a secular person celebrate their wedding. And so it's one of those things that you just wonder, like, what is the next step for you? Because, you know, we in America are just finally getting the ability to have the person of our choice celebrate our marriage. And it seems like you guys have even more complex issue there. And not to mention the discrimination and the negative portrayals in the media that you guys, that you also highlighted in your survey. We have that same problem here, but it seems to be a whole other level. So what do you guys see as the next action steps now that you have this data?
Sammy, you can choose who answers this question.
So, Mazen, any ideas? I'll help you out.
It's definitely, we live in a challenging with a very unique with its difficulties. I think it's because, and if you want to compare it to other Arab countries, where you have one dictator and one people, and so it's kind of a horizontal division between the dictator and the people. And in Lebanon, it's different because we have a vertical division. We have like six or seven dictators, and the people themselves are divided. So I think anything we want to do for change has to do with flipping this division. And we have to unite people from different backgrounds, not just atheists. We have to like bring abroad moderate religious people, the seculars, and we have to change the way the country functions politically in order to have things of democracy, transparency, accountability, all these things, and social trust. Even in marriage, one of the basic things that bring people together is if you are allowed to marry each other. And in Lebanon, that's not allowed. Intermarriage faces many legal obstacles. We actually don't have a personal status law in Lebanon that's run by the state. We have 10 different laws, and each belongs to a different religious group. I just got married 2 weeks ago, and I had to fly to a different country to get a civil marriage and then to get back to Lebanon. So that's the of our country. What can be done? I think right now Lebanon is having a severe economic crisis, and it's an opportunity for change. So I would say just be familiar with what's happening on the ground and support secular and humanist groups. And there are many detailed plans of what can be done, what laws can be changed, what behaviors should be changed at the community level. We have many ideas, but it would take some time to go into all of them.
Thank you, yeah, Mazen. Again, it's a comprehensive solution to Lebanon. Basically, the country is going through a strife for change right now, and anything that pushes towards change towards secular democracy that will help. Yes, Sammy.
I actually need to jump in. I have got to go. I have to go run a board meeting. But thank you so much for having me. And good luck in your research. And if there's any way that CFI can help support you, please contact me or contact Wassam, and I will put you in touch with our other staff people that are working on these issues as well. So again, speaking of joining forces, I think we all need to work together. So thank you very much. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you, Jennifer, very much. And thank you, CFI, for being always there for us.
Thank you. You too.
Sammy, go ahead.
I just wanted to add something that everybody knows there's a problem in Lebanon and everybody wants a solution, but it's just like how to get there, you know? And I think you're aware of the Lebanese situation, Wissam, and right now I think things are way too more complicated that I know there are problems of discrimination against minority groups, but right now this is not a priority, you know? I know it, we know it. And people now, there's like poverty rates are increasing by the day. And in my opinion, the solution to both problems is the same. If you find a solution to economic collapse, which is directly caused by this sectarian system, I think automatically you're going to be solving other problems, and you're going to be guaranteeing the rights of minority groups. But yeah, right now, if you want to call for change, this is not going to be your excuse. You're not going to be saying that I want to protect these minorities, because this is a long fight. And I think there's a very big chance right now in Lebanon for a change. And I don't know how to make use of the situation, what to do. Some people think that what we had, the Thawra, you know, the protests, they were a failure. I think Mazen and I don't think so, and Sarah as well. We think that this was a big step, and maybe this was the second out of the, since, you know, this started in 2015, and there could be other battles or other encounters. So yeah, the question is what to do right now, and I think this is a topic, a very long topic for discussion. So
thank you, Brahim. Go ahead.
Thank you, guys. Okay, so I am the practical type. I'm the pragmatic type. I like to talk about steps that we can take to create real change. What do you think needs to be done on the ground? What do you think we can help with from the United States? What do you think needs to happen in Lebanon to make the situation better? I'm not saying solve the whole problem, just small steps to make things better. And eventually, where do you see the future of, you know, free thought and secularism in Lebanon? I'm just gonna like elaborate a little bit on my own thoughts when I think of what you said about Lebanon having, like, you know, every other country has one dictator and one people, and you have different dictators and different people. It seems to me that this, there's a more need for secularism in Lebanon than any other Arab country. Like, it seems to me that it would make more sense there, because it's just, it's such an, well, to me, it's a no-brainer. Like, you know, you have problems with different sects. Well, secularism, you like that. That's what going to put everybody on equal footing. That's what should eventually lead to, you know, progress in my mind. But where do you see things? What do you think are the next steps that need to be done on the ground to make the reality of people's lives better?
So I think if there's a difference if you want to discuss small and big change. Small change in terms of like widening a bit the spaces of freedoms, this can always be done. This can be done by, if you have funds, you can invest in projects like the one we did. You can push for changing, minorly changing some laws, you know. And this is what we are doing. This is what the LGBT community are doing. This is what the feminist collectives are doing as well. And change is happening, you know. Some laws are being changed. So on this scale, I'm pretty optimistic when it comes to just like working on the small scale. When it comes to big changes, which is like changing the whole system, secularism, introducing secularism, this is a whole different discussion, because so Lebanon is governed by a big mafia, you know, and there's international politics which is interfering in everything. Every one of the dictators in Lebanon is being dictated by somebody outside of the country. So it's a very big and complicated thing. If you want to talk about changing the constitution, everybody is scared. This is something I don't think that should be discussed. So this is why I always think that it's better to discuss changing laws than changing a constitution. Mazen, I feel you want to say something.
Sure. So definitely secularism is the way to go. But some of the Lebanese constituents fear secularism, specifically like Muslims are against secularism as a principle, and the Christians are fearful of secularism because it would mean it in their minds that they would lose power, because right now, demographically speaking, Muslims outnumber Christians in Lebanon, maybe 65% Muslims to 35% Christians.
You feel secularism by definition means democracy?
Yeah, that's I agree with you, but you would actually hear on the streets of Lebanon some Christians they would say something: if we become secular, then Muslims would outnumber us and they would rule the country, because they think democracy is just about the majority rule, and they're not the majority, and then they would lose. So I think sometimes actually we have sectarian leaders like Birri, the speaker of the parliament, and he is a sectarian warlord, and sometimes he uses the words particularly to scare off his Christian opponents. So it's very tricky. So I think we should go for secularism, absolutely, and we should be smart about how we do it. We should be careful about going to trying to misuse the term to attain sectarian goals. So I would say we have some legal work to do, we have some behavioral change to do, we have some social trust building to do. And interestingly, there are many things we have found out in this study. For example, recently, maybe in the 1997, a law was passed that forces public schools to teach religion in public schools. And not just that, but also to divide students according to their religious background. So let's say children are in the same class, you know, studying science and Arabic and English and so on, and then religious class arrives, they are divided. Christians go to this room, Muslims go to that room, Sunnis and Shias, and you have different sheikhs or priests coming and giving that class. So we are taught division from a very young age. So for example, that's one thing we can do to change. Either not teach religion in public schools or change the curriculum to teach something about diversity and learning about other people's religion rather than divide them. There are things about legalizing civil marriage, which are essential. There are things about empowering, like let's say scouts, which are non-religious or non-sectarian or citizenship oriented, as contrasting to the current situation where we have Shia scouts, Sunni scouts, Druze scouts, and so on. So we have lots of work to do. Part of it is on the legal front. Part of it is on changing social dynamics. But I think all these things, as Sami alluded to, do require support and funds to actually make a difference. So we always try to connect with like-minded individuals and groups in the international community who are interested in empowering particular projects, and we can plan them together.
Thank you, Mazen. Sarah, I have a question for you, and we will try to end this in a few minutes. I know the time is really late, and thank you guys for accommodating our time here in the USA. It's beyond midnight for you guys. Sarah, the perception of a lot of people is that the vast majority of the girls, not you, Siri, Sarah, the vast majority of the people in the vast majority of women who wear a scarf, they wear it on their own choice. And especially in Lebanon, the country that is known to be the country of the singers and the beautiful beaches and a tourist attraction at a certain point to most of the Arabs and Muslim world, considered a very liberal country. And many of these girls who might be feel that they are forced to wear hijab, they're not maybe forced physically to wear it, but the situation that they're in might put them in such a position. So can we talk a little bit about that, especially that you had a personal experience about that? And what is if there is a message for our community, our Muslim community, for example, what would be that message? Because sometimes abuse happens at a collective level without really us being conscious about it.
Yeah. So first of all, that's false news that women, or most of the veiled women, wear the veil by choice. No, no, no. Please stop saying this. Obviously, whoever said it was probably a man or a teenager in his reaching his puberty, or a woman who is afraid to say openly that she's wearing it by force. I can guarantee you this. You have no idea. You have no idea how many women wear the veil by force, and you wouldn't know because they would never confined in you, because personally you're a man, and it's a woman who is forced to wear the veil isn't going to come and say it to you, a stranger. Like she would probably say it to someone else, a woman who has passed through the same experience. And they are everywhere. And even you can see it like in some signs on the woman, not always, of course, but by these signs, I mean how they dress, like is their veil too Islamic or not? You can see from the way she's expressing herself that she's trying to not be so expressive with the veil, like this, saying this is not completely my identity. But still, of course, there are women who wear the long, like loose Islamic clothes, and they are wearing it by force. And I know a lot of them who do, and I still know now personally a lot of women who are wearing it by force. And even after publishing my first article, a lot of women contacted me, and I was shocked by the amount of feedback I received from them, just wanting to share their stories and telling me, I'm wearing it now by force and I can't take it off because my family would kill me, I would be physically abused. And it's, as you said, it's not only physical abuse, it's the pressure put by the society too. That can be emotional pressure or verbal abuse that can make the woman cave in and still wear it instead of having enough courage to take it off. And these women mainly need just someone to encourage them and tell them, you're not alone, I'm like you. And as I did it, you can do it. And I heard this from many of the females who contacted me. They were telling me, oh, you're like, you being vocal like helped me to gain more courage and to take the step and take it off. And I think as a message, well, that's something that I haven't really thought of. But now what comes to my mind is that usually because people say, no, the girls choose to wear it on their own. Oh, yes, she said, yeah, I want to wear it. But let's look at the girl. She's like 8 years old, 10 years old. A girl at such an age can't really make such a life-changing decision. She's probably happy to wear it because everyone around her wears it. And she's going to get gifts and will get a party from her surrounding. That's why she's wearing it, not because she loves it. And later, when she grows up, she's not gonna wanna wear it anymore. She's gonna change because people change. We're humans. We're not the same person we were 5 years ago. So what about 10 or more years ago? So as you now, you're a different human being than you were in the past. This woman who, or this girl now that you're gonna first to wear the veil, is gonna change in the future and will have her own thoughts and might wanna take it off. So just don't judge them. Don't immediately say, oh, she's a prostitute, or oh, someone else has put that thought into her mind. No, people can have thoughts on their own. And this is an issue that we usually face with, I don't think only Lebanese parents, but mainly Middle Eastern parents in general, and I'm sure in other cultures too, that whenever their kid takes a decision on their own that opposes the opinion of their parents, they immediately accuse someone else of planting this idea in their children's heads. But no, accept that your children can have thoughts of their own and they can be different, and there's nothing wrong with that as long as they are not hurting others.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah. Ibrahim, you have any question before we ask the final couple of questions?
No, no questions, really. I just want to, like, you know, I want to thank you again, everyone, for all your hard work. It's great work, and it's absolutely needed. And I hope that it will become a pattern or set some sort of roadmap for other organizations in other Middle Eastern countries to follow, because, you know, It's a great example, and I have to say, I just want to remind myself and remind you that with all the problems that Lebanon has, Lebanon is one of the better examples in the region. So it just shows like where when we have a little bit of freedom that we can speak about these things, what information we can find.
Yeah, true. If showing the best case scenario is like this, then we exhibit A is enough to make a point. We really have come to an end to our program. I wanted to mention some of the aspects of the survey that has been done, including some of the outrageous statements made by many officials and media people. For example, Tony Khalifa, who is one of the very popular hosts, TV hosts in Lebanon, who always interviews people with all kind of different opinions, political and social and economical. But when he had an interview with an atheist guest, he went nuts almost. He was very abusive to him, really, and became angry on TV in reaction to that. And that's kind of the normalized reaction towards atheism in Lebanese society. But we have left a link to Free Thought Lebanon in the comments section, where you can find all the details of the research and all the videos. Three of them have been published on the Free Thought Lebanon YouTube channel and Facebook. And there's one more, Sami, right, that's coming up. And it will be posted soon. And to support the organization's work, you can always also get in contact with it through its website. Any final words, Sami and Mazen?
I want to thank you guys for this, Ibrahim. I want to apologize we weren't able. I know you seem like a very pragmatic person and you want like direct answers, but
I want to win, Sami. I want to win.
Yeah, I understand, but the problem is we all know what the solution is, we just don't know how to do it. You know, it's a big problem everybody's facing in Lebanon. So what I would say now is that we need international support, we need political pressure. How to do this is like a matter of discussion, but we do need international support, because Lebanese people on their own are not being able to push forward at this time. And of course, political support is more harder, but from the international community, even sometimes things as little as statements or sharing one article could help, you know. So I'm sure we're going to have more encounters and we can discuss this in more details. So yeah, thank you all for this. And Mazen, would you like to add anything, or Sarah?
I would also like to thank you. It's been a very rich, intense discussion. And on a personal level, living in Lebanon is different on a daily basis. We have power cuts. Many times you can't get fuel for your car in the gas stations. Things are tough. There are no you can't get money out of an ATM. So I think many times we feel tired and exhausted, and it's always heartwarming, and genuinely we feel that we're not alone when we meet with our international friends and allies. So thank you for supporting us, for being there for us, and we hope we get to collaborate more in the future.
Thank you, Mazen. So among all the problems that are facing Lebanon today, and among all the suffering of its people because of the political status quo that is in position, the atheists suffer even more with the social pressures and discrimination. I want to say to the audience that is belongs to any organized religion that you can help always people, just like we try to strive for tolerance and coexistence with all religions. Atheism is also a philosophy and a way of life and a way of thinking that also needs to be supported, normalized, respected, just like we do to, just like we expected to anyone else. So please play your part in fighting discrimination against non-religious people in your community. And together we will strive for a better world with better human rights. Thank you all for all you do. And thank you for the audience for following. This will be available on YouTube channel, Facebook of Muslimish, and also it will be on Muslimish Freethinkers podcast. and have a great night.
Thank you for listening to Muslimish Freethinkers. Do let us know what you think of this episode at facebook.com/Muslimish. Don't forget to visit us at muslimish.org.